Well, congratulations are in order for Ryan Wade of Langsburg. Ryan learned last week that he's being awarded a full-ride basketball scholarship to Western Michigan University. Ryan's a redshirt freshman in Kalamazoo. But what's really interesting about this is the way that Ryan learned about his scholarship, where he was when he learned about his scholarship, which was at the top of the Eiffel Tower in Paris. Get your brain around that. Brian Calloway in the Lansing State Journal yesterday writing that the team took a trip to Europe. The players happened to be at the top of the Eiffel Tower. Coach Steve Hawkins reaches into his pocket, gives Ryan a letter to open. According to the article, this whole episode naturally was caught on video, which Calloway says has gone viral. Congratulations, Ryan. It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. The Labor Day weekend may have been a relaxing respite for many of us, but it was a busy time for the presidential candidates. On Saturday, GOP nominee Donald Trump visited a black church in Detroit, and Green Party candidate Jill Stein spoke at Eastern Market. Yesterday, former President Bill Clinton headlined the Metro Detroit Labor Day Parade as a surrogate for his wife, Hillary. Election Day is 9 weeks away. How about that? Joining me in the studio to talk about this year's political season, Dr. Matt Grossman. Matt's a political scientist and a director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, IPSR, here at MSU. Matt, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So the presidential campaign ran through Michigan again over the weekend. Trump visited Great Faith Ministries International Church in Detroit on Saturday, a majority African-American congregation. The key line from the speech was that if he's elected, wrongs will be made right. And he was very well received inside the church. What did you make of this visit and Trump's remarks?
Well, fairly typical, somewhat vague remarks from Donald Trump. But I think that it is important for him to be doing this outreach, both so that normal Republican voters don't think of themselves as being in an all-white party, and they see that their candidate is attempting to reach out, and so that he can improve his dismal support among African-Americans that was at 2 or 3% or 0% in some polls. So at that point, you're losing African-Americans who voted against Obama twice. So he has some room to grow, both among African-Americans and white voters who would be concerned about the racial tenor of the campaign.
Among Donald Trump's comments, I'll defend your right to worship, and quote, we need a civil rights agenda for our time. Have you had a chance to gauge the response from the African-American community? How do you think these remarks are going over amongst African-Americans?
Well, most African Americans are Democrats and are likely to support Hillary Clinton. But I think it's useful to keep in mind that at the point that he's has almost no African American support, that means he's not really talking to the whole African American community. He's talking to those people who normally side with the Republicans and have stuck with the Republican Party even through the Obama administration, and at least trying to get those folks on board.
White college educated voters who apparently, according to the data, are taking a while or hesitant about getting behind Trump. It's more a message to that section of the electorate.
Well, I think that's true, but I also think there's always going to be room to grow among African Americans when you start near zero, and so he's just trying to pick up a few points there as well.
Well, outside there were a number of protesters, including Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, who commented that the visit felt like a Madison Avenue image makeover, and felt like he was watching the next season of The Apprentice. Here were the protests pretty much what you would have expected?
I think it was pretty much what you would have expected. And I would say Madison Avenue might be an improvement on what we have been seeing from the Trump campaign. I think there are some signs that the new advisors, particularly Kellyanne, have moved the candidate toward a more traditional campaign, and that may be working toward his favor.
What have GOP presidential candidates who've tried to court the African-American vote before Trump learned about messaging, about shaping their message?
Well, I think they reach out to African Americans on the basis of broad conservatism, on some social conservatism often. And again, we're not thinking that that's a majority of African Americans, just that that will get more than in some prior elections. And I think the other thing they've learned is that you can't be perceived as a racist because that's going to turn voters off immediately. And that's what's happened in this campaign.
Well, we're talking about the flurry of presidential candidates and their surrogates that have visited Detroit here in the last few days. Dr. Matt Grossman's our guest. He's a political scientist and director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research here at Michigan State University. Bill Clinton was in Detroit yesterday to march in the Labor Day parade. He was there just 2 days after Trump's appearance, and he was asked if he was concerned about Trump's pitch to African Americans. Here's former President Clinton.
If we have to do something else to counter it, then you assume that the entire African-American community is suffering from amnesia after what Hillary did for Flint, the work I did with Detroit.
Any response to the Clinton visit or those comments?
Well, this is pretty typical of Democrats to have a specific outreach campaign for African Americans and tout the specific attempts that they've made to solve problems in Detroit and Flint, and it's mostly working.
Historically, Detroit's been a crucial stop on Labor Day for Democrats, but with the troubles that plague Hillary Clinton's campaign as well, the emails, the Clinton Foundation special access, and on, will labor unions be a more difficult voting bloc for her to woo than in the past?
Well, she has more support among teachers unions than Obama had. She has, I think she's doing well among public sector unions. I think the worry for her will be in the turnout campaign, the lack of excitement, particularly among African-Americans and young people, that Obama won by big margins and also saw very large turnout. And so if Hillary is unable to match that, that could be a problem.
There's also been some talk recently, and Mara Eliason talked about this here just a bit ago here on NPR. Apparently in the last few days, we've seen a slight narrowing in the polls. Donald Trump up slightly in relation to Hillary Clinton, but apparently that is more about a bump in Hillary Clinton's negatives than about more support for Donald Trump necessarily. But at the same time, Trump is struggling in some states that are typically in solidly in the GOP column. She referred to Arizona, Georgia, and possibly even Texas. Thoughts on how that is playing out?
Well, I think what you're seeing is that the convention bounce that Hillary Clinton got has dissipated fully at this point. And Trump is back on message and less prone to gaffes in the last couple of weeks. And so you should expect some tightening across the country. I haven't seen much evidence that it's regional so far.
What do you make? She also commented that about half of voters polled say that they are primarily voting against a candidate as opposed to for a candidate. And she pointed out that it's still a close race because they are a couple of the most unpopular candidates in memory. Thoughts
right
on that?
Right. In fact, we don't have any polling that suggests any candidate that has as low favorability ratings as either of our candidates this time. So these are quite unpopular candidates. We're also seeing more third party and decline to state of preference voters than we've seen in previous cycles at this time. So it'll be interesting to see whether traditional Democratic and Republican voters come on board with their candidates. But that is what we would expect to see as we start in with the debates.
Back to the Detroit visits here by some of the candidates. Green Party candidate Jill Stein was also in Detroit on Saturday. You alluded to third party candidates here in your last answer. She focused on reducing poverty and ensuring that Detroiters have access to water. What kind of view do you have with regard to this year's third party candidates, the Greens and the Libertarians for that matter?
Well, we don't have a top-tier third-party candidate this year. Both have run before and gotten less than 1% of the vote. But the The chance for greater than 1% certainly is pretty high. I think the chance that they become a major factor in the race is low unless they manage to make it into the debates, which doesn't seem likely at this point.
I have heard that in the past, third parties may poll higher the earlier in the campaign than later in the campaign, just because the people who were inclined to support them earlier, as voting day approaches, they start to have doubts about the wrong person being elected, and they end up voting accordingly. Is that basically a part of the way you look at this?
It's absolutely true that historically, third-party candidate support declines as we get closer to election day, as people start to think about the wasted vote or the spoiler effect. But it's important to say this year we have not yet seen that. So Gary Johnson's numbers in particular are staying relatively high, and there's some sign that they actually increased somewhat. So we should expect that to happen as we get closer to election day, but we haven't seen it so far.
We have NPR's been reporting on this sporadically throughout the morning here today. We've got an unprecedented situation involving hackers getting into government websites, party websites here. It's a part of the news frequently here in recent months. This would appear to be so far-reaching, potentially, in terms of its impact. How do you, as a political scientist, put that into any kind of perspective?
Well, I think there's not a huge reason to be concerned about effects on our election process, particularly in Michigan, where we have paper ballots and a trail to follow up on any problems. But obviously, it's generally concerning that foreign governments would have access to U.S. websites. We've seen it in the corporate world pretty extensively, and so it may not be a surprise that it's coming to the political world as well.
There's also this crazy dimension to Donald Trump's, I shouldn't have said crazy, but it's unusual in that Trump has said that if Hillary wins, it demonstrates that it was a rigged election. And now we have learned of efforts to hack into these websites. It creates a really turbulent kind of landscape, it would seem to me.
Well, and since 2000, after every election, there have been people who haven't accepted the outcome and have thought that there was some rigging of the process.
This goes back a ways.
There is definitely concern that after November, there'll be a section of the public who doesn't accept the election results.
We are talking about the presidential campaign and the ideologies of the two major political parties. Our guest is Dr. Matt Grossman, political scientist and author of a new book out this week called Asymmetric Politics. You're affiliated with what is called IPSR, the Institute for
Public Policy and Social Research.
Policy and Social Research. A lot of words to keep straight there. And you IPSR runs the Michigan Political Leadership Program, and you are gearing up for another year of activities here. How does it work, and what is happening?
Well, the Michigan Political Leadership Program is a 10-weekend program that trains future political leaders for Michigan. We do nuts and bolts campaigning. We do the governing process, and we do general leadership and organizational development. And it's currently our application period. So this month, you need to get in your applications if you want to be a future politician. You think you can do as well as our current slate of candidates, please throw your hat in and apply for our bipartisan statewide program.
The new class begins in January, but today you're making a special announcement about two upcoming speakers who will be there in March. Tell us more.
Right. So our annual dinner in Livonia and breakfast in Grand Rapids, we will have Howard Dean and Anna Navarro as our two speakers talking about the campaign that we will have just experienced. And I think talking about the future of the parties. Howard Dean was sort of the precursor. The Deaniacs were the precursor to the Bernie supporters. So I think he'll be able to comment on where they may be heading. And Anna Navarro has the difficult task of Latino and female outreach to improve the Republican brand among those constituents after this election.
And how can people apply to the program? I know the registration deadline's coming up pretty soon, actually.
That's right. So you can just go to our website, ippsr.msu.edu, and learn all about the program, and please come join us.
Always fun, always interesting. We want to thank Dr. Matt Grossman. We've been talking about the 2016 campaign trail and political leadership development. Matt is the director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research here at Michigan State. His new book, Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, the environmental community's never been in complete agreement on the benefits of biofuels. Now a University of Michigan researcher claims fossil fuels may actually be better. We'll talk with researcher John DiCicco. That's coming up later on Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Every weekday at noon, hear us on AM 870 WKAR. Baseball fans know Peter Morris of Hazlitt as one of the game's great historians. And there's another game he loves, Scrabble. In 1991, he won the first ever World Scrabble Championships. On Thursday, the silver anniversary of his win will be marked in Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl talked with Peter Morris about his time as the greatest Scrabble player in the world. I'll bet he's been playing all his life, hasn't he, Scott?
He sure has, Mark. Now, his mom played Scrabble with him as a youngster as a means of teaching him new words. He obviously got really good. In the 1980s, he moved to East Lansing from Toronto to be near some other outstanding players so they could play more often. He won the national championship in 1989 and did well enough in other tournaments to earn an invitation to the first world championships 2 years later.
The players were selected based on their computer ratings. And so because I'd won the Nationals a couple of years ago, come second another year, and seventh the next year, I had a very high computer rating. And so I was able to qualify automatically to be one of, in fact, I had a choice. I could either be the U.S. representative or a Canadian representative because I had dual citizenship.
In international competition, I have to assume that the game is played in English. Is that correct?
Yes. It's a world English-speaking Scrabble.
Are there other world championships in other languages?
The French have a championship. And in fact, the last winner was a guy from New Zealand who doesn't speak French, who just memorized the French dictionary.
Oh, my gosh. Now, that's a story.
It was.
All right. So take us to 1991. Where is this first world championship played at?
The first World Championship was played in London, England. There were 48 players from 20 countries. So just getting selected was a real honor.
So more than one from the U.S.?
Yeah, there were eight from the U.S., okay. Three from Canada. I ended up taking one of the U.S. spots. So I was one of the eight from the U.S. And pretty much every English-speaking kind of, England had six or eight players. Australia had two or three. New Zealand had two or three, and then there were quite a few other countries that would send one, and even several countries that weren't English-speaking sent a player who'd played in English, obviously, and some of them had pretty big disadvantages.
What's the format? Is it something along the lines of the NCAA tournament, single elimination, so to speak? How did that work?
No, the format was more like the World Cup of soccer, where they sort of play this preliminary round. They play a round robin and they eliminate. They went from 48 to 16 based on these five preliminary games, and then once they were down to 16, then we played a knockout. But it wasn't a single; it was best two out of three.
Okay.
So at least because Scrabble there is a luck element, so at least that was designed to minimize the luck. To at least you could have a bad game and bounce back and have another chance.
It occurs to me to ask, in international chess competition, there's a clock in the game. Is there a clock in international Scrabble?
There is, and it's exactly like a chess clock. Each player gets a certain amount of time for all of their moves during the game, which means you can conserve your time if you want. You can play fast and conserve your time. You can sort of just ration it, say, okay, 2 or 3 minutes for each move. But if you have an easy decision, I mean, if your first rack is four O's and three U's, you're gonna you don't waste any time. You just go, I'm trading these letters in and hit the clock, and it's on the opponent's time. And the big advantage, I mean, if you're playing fast and you're hitting your opponent's clock, then your opponent has to think on their clock and not on your clock. So there's a lot of advantages to being as fast as you can.
If you build a lead, can you run out the clock?
No. So the game continues until all the tiles are used. And if somebody goes over their clock, then there's a penalty for the 10 points per minute penalty. So you can't run out the clock.
We're talking with Peter Morris of Hazlitt about the 25-year anniversary of his victory in the first World Scrabble Championship. What can you tell us about that championship game?
I qualified for the final 16, and I was able to get through my first three opponents. And so the finals, I was playing a man named Brian Cappelletto, who was a really good friend of mine from Chicago. You know, it's a cordial, but it's also, you know, it's a little difficult playing a really good friend. And so we played 2 out of 3. The first game, I got very good letters and won fairly handily. The second game, he played very well and was able to even it up. So it boiled down to one game. Neither one of us had very good tiles, and we were just kind of plodding through poor tiles. And it came down to he emptied the bag and had 4 tiles on his rack, and so I had 7. And because you're allowed to track tiles in a tournament, you're allowed to, you know what, of course, what the 100 tiles are that you start with. And you're allowed to track tile. You're allowed to keep track of what tiles are played. And, of course, you can see which tiles are played. So I knew at that point what 4 letters he had. So the score is almost tied, and he has EEIR. And I have what looks like a really dreadful rack. I have an M and a B and a V and a W and a, you know, a bunch of tiles that look awful. But fortunately, it's my turn, and there's 2 different ways to use the V for about 30 points. I can use it on the upper right quadrant for about 40 points, or I can use it in the lower left for about 35 points. So I'm figuring out, you know, what would happen if I do one or the other, and then he's got EEIR. So I have to figure out, well, what can he come back with EEIR? The letter D is on the board, so he can play eider through it, E-I-D-E-R, like eider down, eider duck, the feathers, and he's going to go out. And so, okay, if I'm counting it up, and if I make my highest scoring play, my 40-point play, I'm going to lose by 3 points. So now I'm like, okay, now I can't go with that strategy. Now I've got to, so I realize my only chance is to try to figure out a way to, I've got to block eider, and then I've got to preserve my other. So I have to block eider with letters that I'm not going to use, with not using the V, because I want to use the V for either 40 points or 30 points, and then I've got a chance to win. So I played MIB, which got rid of my M and my B, which were two tiles that were 3-point tiles, so I needed to get rid of them. And it blocked eider, and it didn't score a whole lot of points, it scored about 13 points. But now he has no way to go out, and I'm going to get either my 40 or my 30. And so he elects to block my 40-point play, and I take my 30-point play, and he's got 2 1-point tiles. So again, he can't score many points. He gets about 10 points each time, and I win by 4 points.
I have to tell you, it's amazing 25 years later, the precision with which you remember this last game.
Yeah. Well, it was a move. Unfortunately, because I was a fast player and Brian's not the fastest player. I had a lot of time to think about this and to figure out all the permutations and combinations. And the really interesting thing was that they were showing the match in closed circuit TV in the next room with all these expert players. And they'd all concluded that I was going to lose. Nobody could find a way that I was going to win. And when I played MIB, and they were like, he didn't score his points. And, I thought, well, why? But Brian's really left with a conundrum here. And
the best offense is a good defense.
It turned out to be that time, yeah.
So what did Peter Morris win for that World Championship, Scott?
There was a $10,000 prize, a Royal Dalton Crystal Trophy, and, of course, A beautiful dictionary.
Of course. Is he still playing Scrabble?
Not competitively, no. As for friendly games, he says lots of people won't play them. But I did.
Uh-oh.
Here's a bit of that game. I went first.
Gloat.
12?
O-H-M, ohm, under gloat. So you're getting lots of words here.
Yeah, because I got the M doubled. So 6, 10, 12, 13, 15, 16, 20, 21, 27.
I'm already way behind. All right, let's see what I've got here. Jug for 11.
Yeah, so we're tied.
I'm tied with a world champion.
She looks impressed.
You're not impressed, are you? Locks and axe.
Hmm?
Triple A for 3 plus 8 is 11. Plus 8 is 19, 20, 21. Oh my gosh, breeding. You're going to get a bonus?
Okay, so that's, yes. So 50-point bonus is 68.
V-O-E for 12. Q-I twice, which makes 22. I didn't have any doubles in there, did I?
No. Yeah, but you get in as well, so it's 24.
Oh, yes. Vo becomes vos, and with the S, sallied.
80.
80?
Yep.
Holy cow.
You get the picture, Mark. I lost to Peter Morris 463 to 262. He crushed me.
But axe, I love that. Yeah. You were able to play the X, and it's worth 8 in a triple and a double letter, whatever. Thursday night at 7, we'll point out Peter Morris will mark the 25th anniversary of his win in the first World Scrabble Championships at an event at Lansing City Hall in conjunction with the Lansing Has Fun exhibit on display there. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
And coming up on Current State, the first year of this year's MSU College of Music faculty recitals happens on Wednesday. We'll learn why soprano Melanie Helton has called her performance Lover's Lullaby, an evening of excruciatingly bad songs.
Four Ducks on a Pond, which I find hysterically funny, is actually one of my mother's favorite songs. So I feel bad that I'm making fun of it. Not really.
Melanie Helton later this hour on Current State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Every Tuesday, Current State spends a few minutes exploring environmental news and issues. Today, we look at a recent University of Michigan study that's generating disagreement in the biofuel community. For years, many environmentalists and researchers have pointed to the benefits of burning corn ethanol, for example, instead of gasoline or other fossil fuels. The crops are renewable, of course, and better for the environment. But a study released last month by our next guest and his colleagues at the University of Michigan casts doubt on that environmental claim. To explain, we welcome Dr. John DiCicco. Mr. DiCicco is a research professor at the U of M Energy Institute in Ann Arbor. In the past, he's been a lecturer and clinical professor of natural resources and the environment at U of M. Dr. DiCicco, welcome.
Good to be with you this morning, Mark.
You studied a 9-year period from 2005 through 2013 when biofuel use grew quite noticeably. And the takeaway from your study contradicts what many people have said for years is a key advantage to biofuels, namely that burning biofuels as opposed to fossil fuels lowers the quantity of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And what's at the center of your study is this principle of CO2 uptake. So before we get into what exactly you found, just explain in the simplest terms you can just the basic principle of CO2 uptake.
Sure, Mark. Well, when plants grow, they pull CO2 from the atmosphere. That's called photosynthesis. Plants are really the basis of the food chain on Earth. You know, when they grow, they make carbohydrates by using sunlight and water plus CO2, and you end up with simple sugars that they build into carbohydrates that they can then build into plant proteins and fats and the structural material, you know, tree fibers, bark, corn stalks,
okay,
bean pods. So all of that is carbon that used to be in the atmosphere that's been converted by the plants into some form of what we call biomass.
And you found that the CO2 uptake was not able to keep up with biofuel emissions. Again, as simply as possible, talk to us about that.
Sure. First of all, it's important to remember that when you burn a biofuel, such as ethanol instead of gasoline or biodiesel instead of diesel in a truck, you're burning a carbon-based fuel. Carbon, in many ways, is the fuel of life. You know, we burn carbos for energy. Cars and trucks burn carbon-based fuels for energy. And anytime you burn a fuel that has carbon in it, you emit CO2. And so the amount of CO2 that comes out of a tailpipe when you use a biofuel instead of a fossil fuel doesn't differ. I mean, it differs based on little chemical differences, but not more than about 1% or 2%. So, in short, if biofuels have a benefit for the climate, it's not when they're burned. It's not at the point where they're consumed and they emit CO2 into the atmosphere at the same rate as the fossil fuels. They only have a benefit if they pull CO2 from the atmosphere more quickly than it's already being pulled from the atmosphere by plants growing on land. And that's what I mean by the CO2 uptake factor. CO2 uptake, like I explained, refers to photosynthesis, and on a farm field, it represents how quickly CO2 is being pulled from the air into the growing biomass, whether that's a corn plant or a soybean plant or just normal grass or trees or whatever.
Your study has generated a lot of criticism and disagreement here in the biofuels community. I mean, it's one thing to say that not all the greenhouse gases from biofuels are absorbed, but I take it it's another thing to say that it's even worse than using gasoline, and you have said that. Is that indeed a takeaway from your study?
Yes, it is.
Can you help us understand that, please?
Sure. What my study does is actually rebuts, or shall we say falsifies, the assumption about CO2 uptake that has been made in all the prior studies about biofuels, all the studies that claimed that biofuels are better than fossil fuels because they simply recycle CO2 from the atmosphere. So all these studies were done with computer models, and baked into those computer models was an assumption that you could fully and completely credit all of the CO2 uptake on the land growing the crops used to make biofuels against those emissions that occur at the tailpipe when the biofuels are burned. What I did differently was say, well, wait a minute. If a cornfield is already pulling CO2 from the air when that corn is being harvested for cattle feed, for corn chips, going into our food system, however it might go into our food system, just because you then shift some of the harvest to make biofuels, have you speeded up how quickly the corn crop is pulling CO2 from the air? No, you haven't. And so I then went to the field data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and over the period that you mentioned, from 2005 through 2013, I looked at the data on crop growth and yields. I converted that to carbon uptake, which is really just a chemical calculation based on the composition of different crops, and I found that the amount of CO2 pulled out of the air over this period only amounted to 37%, just a little more than a third of the CO2 that was emitted when the biofuels were burned, instead of covering 100% of those emissions. And that's a huge difference, and that difference is enough to shift biofuels from looking like they're a benefit to the climate to looking like they're worse than just burning gasoline.
How about that? Now, could another credible researcher take the same deep dive that you took into this ag data? You looked at Department of Agriculture crop data. Could another credible researcher come to a different conclusion than you did?
No. No, my analysis conceptually was actually quite straightforward. What's different is I'm the first one to use the data to actually explicitly do the accounting rather than making assumptions about it.
You have taken, what do you make of the criticism here? I mean, we've got Emily Score, CEO of Growth Energy, which is a biofuels or a company, citing a study from the Department of Energy's Argonne National Laboratory showing that ethanol is an earth-friendly biofuel that reduces greenhouse gas emissions by an average of 34% over their lifestyle. Score says the latest reports are just another desperate attempt to discredit the nation's most successful clean energy program. Really divisive study that you've come up with here.
Well, the folks at Growth Energy and many other, interests and companies, and including the folks at Argonne National Laboratory who do these computer models, are relying on a form of computer modeling that my work, and not just my work, other scientists over the last few years have fundamentally discredited. So they're citing essentially their own studies, studies that have been done for years and years, making an assumption that is not borne out when you look at what's going on actual cropland.
Is that the critical difference here, then? It's the difference between a computer model and actual data.
Absolutely.
Now, you've taken heat from...
All of this debate for years has been based on computer modeling, assumptions about kind of an idealized world in which biofuels were completely carbon neutral. The models represented a situation as if the corn that was used to make biofuels had been a desert beforehand, that there was no photosynthesis going on. And that's simply not true in the real world. So they unfortunately have been caught up in an imaginary world of computer models for years and years and years that sadly has shaped public policy.
You've taken heat from people over this study who say it's not credible because the work was underwritten by the American Petroleum Institute. What do you say to those critics?
Well, I think the fact that the work was underwritten in part by the Petroleum Institute does raise some eyebrows. On the other hand, this was a study that I proposed to them. I've been doing work on this subject for many years, and my core mathematical results before I went to the field data that pointed to similar conclusions were done long before I obtained the funding from API. And the funding from API was done under a standard university contract, protects academic freedom. There was no restriction on what we should or should not say in the study. So really, the analysis is completely my own.
We want to thank Dr. John DiCicco. He's a research professor and at the University of Michigan Energy Institute in Ann Arbor. We've been talking about his recent study, which finds that the advantages of biofuels are much overestimated here, and he actually goes so far as to claim that burning gasoline may be better environmentally than biofuels. Dr. John DiCicco, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Current State discusses Michigan's environment every Tuesday. Our segments and others about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and at WKAR.org. Well, the start of the MSU school year also means the start of plenty of College of Music recitals. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Professor Melanie Helton about hers tomorrow night, which will be the first faculty recital of the year, but Professor Helton's program has a rather unusual theme.
Lover's Lullaby, an evening of excruciatingly deliciously bad songs.
They call it a lover's lullaby. With a sigh. Its message to you is ever new.
Now, when you say that, what comes to mind is now that we've got the movie of Florence Foster Jenkins coming up with Meryl Streep, or that's out in theaters, that's a different sort of bad song experience for the audience that we're talking about with your recital.
I would hope so, because I actually can sing. As can Meryl, but she trained quite assiduously to sing that badly, and quite brilliantly, I might admit.
So the content of Lover's Lullaby is mostly cabaret songs, or what era are the songs coming from?
I would say primarily from the teens and the 20s, some into the 30s, and they're not actually bad musically. They're usually, like, some, we have a whole travelogue that's a little politically incorrect nowadays. We have a really lovely song about a guy who is all dressed up with no place to go, and it gets more and more pathetic as it goes on. Lover's Lullaby, which is an exercise in range jumping. It has a 2-octave range, which, unlike you hear pop stars say they have 8 octaves, nobody has 8 octaves. If you have 2, you're an opera singer. So,
what made you create this kind of song cycle, this journey of excruciatingly bad songs?
Actually, it began when I first got here to MSU, and a former colleague, Alan Gossman, had done this. He had gotten his PhD at Harvard, and he had collected a bunch of these songs, and we did the concert here with him using many of the songs that he'd found. As I went through my boxes of old sheet music that had belonged to my mother and my aunt, both of whom are musicians, I found more gems. In fact, Four Ducks on a Pond, which I find hysterically funny, is actually one of my mother's favorite songs. So I feel bad that I'm making fun of it. Not really.
Now, your collaborator for this concert coming up Wednesday night, tell me about him.
Derek Polishuk is my dear beloved colleague with whom I have done both standard recitals and as well as, this is our third foray into what we call bad music. We usually do it at the beginning of the year. It's a great way to show the students that we have a sense of humor. If you'll look carefully at the program, I've written fake bios for us, which are hopefully people will find amusing. Derek is a brilliant pianist. He and I just collaborated on a CD of Schumann's Dichterliebe and Kahane's Kriegslistlieder, sort of a compilation of 19th century angst and 21st century neurosis. And Derek has been my partner in crime, and I adore collaborating with him. He'll do anything. He sings, he plays off the piano, he'll pound, he makes sound effects. It's been great, and we have a great time.
I found an old musty book, long lost in some far-forgotten nook. In the book of faded picture and the scent of faded perfume, two old-fashioned lovers in an 18th century drawing room.
That's an interesting pairing, Dichterliebe and Kriegslistlieder. So it's poet's love and then no strings attached type of love?
Well, it's more about sort of the way we deal with things in the 21st century, which is to be neurotic about it, as opposed to the way we deal with it in the 19th century, which is to be deeply aggrieved. And the famous song, Ich grohle nicht, I'm not bitter, you know. But what we found was both cycles were a journey, and they were a journey from sort of love's follies and how we deal with it in somewhat the same way in two different eras.
We're speaking with the MSU College of Music artist faculty member, Melanie Helton, who has, on this Wednesday evening, the first faculty artist recital coming up at the Fairchild Theater, 7:30 p.m. is that performance. And as I said, it's the first one of the season for essentially all of the artist faculty. Is in terms of the nuts and bolts of the College of Music, is an annual recital something that's part of the artist faculty experience?
It's. I would say that it is encouraged, and if you know, if you look at our schedule, there's something amazing going on pretty much every night of the week. We have our West Circle series, which has been very, very popular chamber music series, which focuses around the work of one conductor, often in a birthday year. And we also have Cello Plus, we have the opera, we have jazz, we have the symphony and the wind symphony, choral units. So we really do have something going on every single night of the week, not to mention the thousands of student recitals that happen in our own building in Cook. But the faculty really enjoy it. And what's been a blessing for me is the fact that I've been able to collaborate with musicians that, had I continued my life as a professional singer, or I mean I did, but were I not teaching, no one would ever have asked me to sing the Bacchianus Brasileiros with six cellos, or eight cellos, or to sing the last piece of the Barcelona Olympics with the symphony, a Montsalvace piece. So I've gotten to do things I never would have been hired to do that aren't just done out in the regular realm. And that's been the blessing of the collaboration. And I think probably by the time I retire, I will have done a recital with almost everyone on the faculty. Probably the most unusual was I did a piece for soprano and tuba with Professor Philip Sinder, which was quite amusing. It must be hell's bell.
Now, you mentioned the opera a second ago, and I think that's interesting that this recital you'll get out of the way and pretty much, I assume, dive straight into the MSU Theater opera production that's coming up in November. Auditions are probably right around the corner since classes are just beginning. What can you tell us about that opera that's coming up?
Well, we're doing Donizetti's L'Elisir d'Amore, or The Elixir of Love, very, very famous, particularly for the tenor aria Una Furtiva Lagrima, which Pavarotti sang probably on every concert. We've already started. We started music rehearsals on Thursday, and they're actually coaching today, which is a Sunday, and they're actually coaching on Labor Day. But I'm having everyone for hot dogs after the coaching so they don't feel so bad about having to work on the holiday. But it's a charming comedy, lots of fun for all ages, sung in Italian, but we always use the English surtitles on top of the stage, so it's pretty clear to see what's going on anyway. And performances will be the weekend before Thanksgiving.
Let's go back to your collaborator that's coming out. I almost used the very bad word, and it's that distinction that I want to ask you about is some people use the word accompanist and some use kind of pianist collaborator. Which do you think would be more appropriate for Professor Poloshuk?
Definitely pianist collaborator, although he says he doesn't mind if he's called an accompanist. I think that the bond between pianist and singer has to be so equal. And even though one may take the forefront at one time or another, It always has to be a collaboration. When Derek and I were working on the Dichterliebe, we talked about every single bit of text, how we wanted to color that text, what Schumann really meant by a particular tempo marking, how far could we go afield from that tempo marking. So collaborator, to me, is the best word. I think it's just become more in vogue now as well. And accompanist has gone a little out of vogue.
I'm the queen of the bath. When singing in the bathtub. Never take a shower, it's an awful pain. Sinking in the bathtubs like singing in the rain. All the dirt to be abolished, but don't forget what...
A Lover's Lullaby, An Evening of Excruciatingly Bad Songs, comes up Wednesday evening. It's the first of the MSU College of Music artist faculty recitals, featuring soprano Melanie Helton and pianist Derek Poloshuk. The performance will be at the Fairchild Theater, 7:30 p.m. More information at music.msu.edu. Professor Helton, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Starting tomorrow here on Current State at 12 o'clock noon tomorrow, We will be broadcasting live from in front of the state capitol for the launch of the fall state legislative session. We'll be looking ahead at what's in the session, what Rick Pluta and Kathy Gray, veteran capitol reporters, expect from this session. Also, we'll be visiting with a number of elected officials, including GOP senators Rick Jones and Phil Pavlo, about the upcoming session. Also, we'll speak with critics of the appointment of Heidi Grether, former British Petroleum spokesperson, to run Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality. The confirmation hearings begin tomorrow down there, and we will be live again at noon, during the noon hour, right in front of the state capitol. We'll be talking with some of those critics of that appointment, also Democratic Representatives Tim Grimmel and East Lansing Representative Sam Singh. Tim Muffet of the LSO will stop by as well. So we'll be covering all the bases live from the state capitol, 12 o'clock noon, tomorrow on AM 870 WKAR. That and more on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. Everything we do becomes a part of the Current State podcast. Informative, insightful, and indispensable. Everything that's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Hope you can join us tomorrow, again, live at noon from in front of the state capitol. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. See you tomorrow.